Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, host of the Her Podcast. Welcome to our show in episode 464. I'm just exhausted saying that. Oh my gosh. As we share the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her regrets. As women, we got regrets. We kind of do regrets in a very special way. And you'll be hearing more about that in a moment because this is such a special show. I know it'll really touch you deeply. Before we begin, please know that this episode is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. And these are vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature. They've got a special gift for women, the new award-winning Her Life Stages products. They really support a woman from her menstrual years, including PMS, through perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. This is an integrative, holistic approach to having a woman's back throughout her life journey. To learn more, listen, if you want to know more about Her Life Stages, run on over to your local health food store because they're smarty pants and they'll be able to help you. Or run on over to solaray.com and use the promo code HER20 for 20% off. You'll be glad you did. All right, here's your first reminder. Click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review this wonderful show because we love to hear from you. Period. End of story. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life. It's all about Her.
I don't know. On my tombstone, if I have one somewhere, I want to have two words on it. No regrets. I want to be able to say, hey, you know, I kind of lived life to the fullest and I rocked and rolled. I know that sounds kind of weird, but, you know, this whole issue of regret really hits home for so many of us as we especially reach midlife. And we're looking back and reflecting on our own lives. I really want to bring to bear an expert in the field, Dr. Robert Leahy. And Dr. Leahy is a well-regarded, renowned expert in this field who has studied this in depth. He was educated at Yale University and is the founder and director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy in New York City. Clinical professor of psychology in psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College and past president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. He wrote a book that absolutely resonated with me, and it is called If Only, Finding Freedom from Regret. I thought that this book really just absolutely hit home on this whole issue because I constantly hear about this as a physician. And people come to me saying, you know, everything is great in my life, whatever, but if only, and then you fill in the blank. And it seems like they're hung up there. They're kind of stuck. They need tools to be able to navigate this. So I thought that Dr. Leahy would be the perfect person to really clarify this. So Robert, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on, Pam.
Why did you write this book?
Well, the thing that's interesting, I do cognitive behavior therapy and, you know, we treat anxiety and depression, anger problems, couples issues, but there really wasn't anything in the literature in the clinical area dealing with regret. And we know that from the research, regret is the second most commonly mentioned emotion. In conversations where love or liking is the most common emotion. And we know that some people get hung up on regret sometimes for years or even decades. We also know that some people don't anticipate regret or don't learn from regret. So it seems like a very pervasive, very important emotion in everybody's life, potentially. And it's part of any decision, the potential for regret. So it got me interested. And so I always want to write a book that's going to be interesting for me to read.
Oh, I love that. And as an author myself, that's exactly what I say. If I'm like asleep by, you know, chapter one, it's like, no, this isn't going to work for me at all. But it's got to have wit and wisdom, both of which you have.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you.
Well, not just kind, it's accurate, because trust me, I'd tell you otherwise. But so, you know, let's go down that coulda, shoulda, woulda path. Where does that come from? To me, it's so fascinating that some people just don't get stuck there. Something happened, they missed an opportunity, and then they kind of leverage that into something more positive going forward. Other people are like, I can't believe I did that. Coulda, shoulda, woulda, and whatever. What happens in the mind there?
Well, that's a very complicated question in a sense, but let me unpack that. All emotions evolve because they have some adaptive function, like jealousy, envy, even resentment, the desire for revenge. You might think they're bad emotions or unpleasant emotions, but from an evolutionary point of view, they have a place. And in my view, regret is one of those complex emotions that can be adaptive or can be maladaptive. So, for example, there's some people who don't anticipate regret, and as a consequence, they engage in very risky behavior. So people who overdrink or misuse drugs or alcohol or don't save money or don't comply with medical direction or who just say whatever on their mind without considering the consequence, those people experience very, very negative consequences. The absence or the sort of lack of sufficient anticipating regret is probably even a more serious problem than having too much regret. I mean, people get killed by driving their cars or their motorcycles too fast or overusing drugs and alcohol. So anticipating regret can be adaptive. And of course, having too much regret can be maladaptive, where people ruminate and, you know, dwell on things for weeks or years or whatever. So why do some people have more of this regret and ruminate about it? Well, one thing could be that regret is always part of the expectation that you have about an outcome. So if you get married or you get divorced, whatever, and you expect the outcome is going to be absolutely perfect, you're going to be disappointed. So having realistic expectations often is something that's a problem for people who have regrets. Another part of it is the flexibility. So changing your expectations to match reality. And then, as you just said just a few moments ago, Pam, thinking about what I can learn from this to make things better in the future. So I think about productive regret as, you know, I said something or I did something that had a negative outcome. I'm going to take responsibility from that. I'm going to learn from that experience, and I'm going to try to make things better in the future. I'll try to learn from my mistakes. But there are some people who don't learn from their mistakes and just keep making the same mistake.
I was just curious, you know, to kind of jump in here. Seems like there are certain populations that might be more vulnerable to this. Certainly the addictive population, which has a real problem with, as we know from the literature, resilience. So when something bad happens, they immediately default to an addictive behavior for a little anesthesia, as it were, totally simplifying that. But can I ask you to think about women? Is there a gender specificity in the manifestation of regret?
So generally speaking, what the research seems to show is that there are a lot of similarities between men and women in regret. Having said that, men are somewhat more likely to have regrets about achievement than women, although women have regrets about achievement as well. Women are more likely than men to have more regrets about romantic relationships and sexual behavior, but so are men, but women somewhat more likely. Women are more likely to have regrets about having sex after knowing someone for fewer than 24 hours. Women who voluntarily choose not to have children have fewer regrets later than women who wanted to have children but were for some reason unable to have children. there are a lot of similarities between men and women, although the content areas may be somewhat different.
Interesting. You know, I was trying to think about this in terms of how women and rumination and kind of, you know, doing that Cuisinart in the brain, you know, just put that thought in there and just let it whir around for quite some period of time. I mean, does that play into maybe obsessing about a particular regret?
That's an excellent point, Pam. So what we know about women and rumination, I mean, you can make a distinction between regrets and ruminating. Like I can have a regret that I took a particular highway route and say, well, it would have been better off if I took an alternative. But that thought might last for 5 minutes. But rumination is, I love your image of the Cuisinart.
It's like a terrific image. You put a little idea. I came up with that years ago. There's this one, you know, woman I was working with who just like, let it go.
That's right. So we know from the work by Susan Nolan, the late Susan Nolan Hoxima at Yale on rumination and the work of other people on rumination, that women are much more likely to ruminate. And rumination leads to depression for many people, leads to the likelihood of staying depressed longer and for having more frequent episodes of depression. Now, some people have argued, there's been some research at Yale, that there may be some genetic or biological or brain functions that are slightly different that make women a bit more likely to ruminate than men. But, you know, women we know are much more likely to be depressed or have what we call generalized anxiety disorder than men do. I mean, there could be other factors, obviously, in terms of power differential, lack of opportunities, unrealistic expectations that society has for women, that they should be full-time mothers and full-time professionals at the same time. So there are some differences in rumination. But having said that, we do see regret across the lifespan. And kids who express regret, and kids start showing regret between the ages of about 4 and 7. And interestingly, Pam, kids who express regret are better able to make decisions and they're better able in regulating their emotion. So why would that be? And it might be because the kid makes a mistake. They say, oh my God, I should have done something different. And then they think, well, let me try to change that. So learning from mistakes, I think, is a productive use of regret at times. An even more efficient way of learning from mistakes is learning from the mistakes of other people. Like when I was in college and in graduate school, a lot of my peers and my friends were misusing alcohol and drugs. And I could see the outcome for them. And I thought, gee, the only thing I have of any value really is my brain. So I'm going to learn from their mistakes. That's a kind of vicarious regret learning paradigm, you might say. I think the other way in which you can think about regret that can be useful, and we can think about the women in the audience, is the productive use of guilt and apology. So we often think that, oh, guilt is a bad emotion, but why would guilt evolve in every society? So if you think about it, like you're looking for a life partner and that person says, well, I really like you. You're attractive, intelligent, wonderful person, but you should know something about me. I'm totally incapable of regret, guilt, or shame, and I never apologize. I think,
deal breaker.
Right. And so we want people in our lives who we trust or want to trust, we want them to be trustworthy. We want them to have kind of an inner guide, their guilt or shame, that they wouldn't do it because they would feel it is wrong. Again, it's a matter of balance. You don't want somebody going around criticizing themselves all the time. You want kind of the right balance. People who actually express guilt and who make convincing apologies, not, oh, I'm sorry, move on. That's not a convincing apology. People who make convincing apologies are better able at healing the ruptures in relationships. And I think many of the people listening to this can probably identify people who are not good at making apologies or who never make apologies.
You know, just sort of playing off that, One question I got from my team member, knowing that I was going to be speaking with you, she said, ask him this. I said, okay. So when is regret a normal? Is that a normal thing, right? Number two, when does it start traversing into abnormal?
Excellent question. So I think a way of looking at it, Pam, is that to have regret about the right things in the right way and dealing with it with the right kinds of changes. So for example, if you say something unkind to your partner and you care about your partner and you want to be fair, that having regret about that, expressing it, apologizing and making a change in your behavior, maybe trying to identify your anger problem, owning up to it. That would be, I think, the productive way of thinking about regret. The unproductive way of thinking about regret is feeling guilty for not being perfect. And then, as you pointed out earlier, Pam, you know, dwelling on it for weeks or years, or hating yourself for it, or avoiding people because it reminds you of your regrets. So it's having regret about the right things in the right way, to the right degree, and coping with it in the right way.
Yeah, I think women have a problem. I mean, maybe everybody, who knows, vulnerable populations, they tend to slip down the shame, blame, guilt rabbit hole, and suddenly they're just overwhelmed with the whole thing. Maybe in my oversimplified way of looking at this after reading your absolutely superb book, what I was thinking about was regret is a past. Something happened. Now, it either didn't happen, you refused an invitation, or what, it was an event that took place in the past. And I've always looked at the past as mostly good for learning. You could either learn a lot in terms of good things, bad things, upside, downside. Wow, I didn't know I had such a great sense of humor. Or it could be a nothing burger. You know, it's like, well, nothing much happened and it was like an hour in the garden and that's great. So I see regret as a piece of the past that has really hit you deeply and that you need to manage and somehow transform it into a life lesson.
I think you're right, Pam. And I think a way of looking at it, we have these intrusive thoughts about, let's say, regret or envy or jealousy or resentment, whatever. I think a way of looking at it is, one is to normalize having regret. I mean, everybody has regrets at some point. It's part of living a full life. You know, as I said earlier, regret is a potential part of any decision. So I would normalize. I would validate that it's an unpleasant experience to have. But I would think about your life or my life or anybody's life as you're on a train and you have stops on the train. Your life is a journey. Let's say you make a mistake and you feel regrets about it. You can get off at the next stop and stand there for 3 months criticizing yourself, or you can get back on the train and move on to the next station on your journey. And you could ask yourself, how am I going to make my life better in the future? If you think about regret from an evolutionary point, it has evolved as a way for us to consolidate our learning and say, oh, I really learned a lot from that mistake. You know, as I say in the book, don't waste a good mistake. I mean, mistakes are learning experiences. So what did I learn? I go on to the next part of my journey. It's like thinking about your life as a set of chapters, and you're going to be the author of the next chapter in your life. What do you want that to be? Do you want that to be a better partner, a better friend, a better professional, better health, whatever? Each time you make a mistake, you can think about, how am I going to use that to build a better future? One of the ways I like to think about, it's very common for people to say, just live in the present moment. But last time I checked, the only creature that lives entirely in the present moment is a mosquito. So I'd like to live in all the moments of my life and think about what I was like when I was younger, things I did, as you were saying before, things I did that were positive, some things that negative, how I can build a better me in the future. What can I learn from that? How can I aim for a better future self? So for example, if we think about using regret productively, for example, what we know, and you're a physician, you know this better than I do, a lot of patients who are prescribed medication a year later are not taking the medication. Whereas like for hypertension or diabetes, they should be taking the medication for forever or for years, certainly. But half the people who are prescribed medication for high blood pressure a year later don't take it. But when they intervene and they say, I want you to think about 5 or 10 years from now, if you don't take your medication, you could have a stroke, be in a wheelchair, unable to speak, whatever. That leads to people more likely to take their medication. Or saying to young people who generally don't save for the future, you know, you're 30 years old and all that. So let's say you have another 30, 35 years of saving. At your current saving rate, how do you think you'd be able to live at the age of 65? And so having them think about how much money will I have to retire when I'm 65, that actually increases savings rates. So thinking about using the future self as I'm aiming for the future self. So, okay, so I didn't save enough money. Now I really need to start saving. I need to start taking the medication. I need to start dieting. I need to start exercising. Regret is, it's kind of like an opportunity emotion. It's kind of like, oh, I could have done something differently. But that's always true. You know, people have the fear of missing out.
Well, wasn't there a movie with Julia Roberts, I think, or something, you know, Taking the Other Door? It shows two different iterations of her life in this one particular thing, and very different just by taking a different door, which, you know, I'm going to play on that a little bit. At the end of your book, you did something which I love. It's something I love to do as well when I write, and that is to kind of, you know, go back. Let's go back to where we started here for a minute, and let's just see if we can kind of summarize some of the highlights here. And there was one that really hit home. It was the very first one. So I'm going to read from your book. I thought I would finish this book by going back to where we started with the 8 habits of highly regretful people. Remember how we laugh together at how we often think about our decisions in ways that almost guarantee we will have regrets? Well, here's the list in case you've forgotten. And let's look at some things that we have learned. Here goes. Now, this first one kind of plays off what you just said. And I'm going to give you the story that goes with it. So the first one is look back on your life and think of how much better off you would have been if you had done something else. And in all seriousness, this harkens to a patient who had been abused as a child by someone not in the family. And this was very tough for this one particular person. And it interfered with schooling because of the residual effects. And this individual then ended up picking up schooling later on and took it off, but missed out on some very important milestone years in junior high, high school, laying down a foundation for being able to do a dream job they had, which they really wanted to do. Let's just say engineering, okay? But they didn't have the foundation because they had to get a GED for high school and did make it into college and finished college, but really has always had this thought, if only the child abuse had never taken place. My immediate thought was, that wasn't your fault. You were a kid and it happened to you. You didn't choose one way or the other, but they just have this, if only, then I could have been. There you have it. So I added a nuance here, which is sort of a trauma thing, which is extremely common, much more common than most people appreciate, and you're the expert, so you probably know that better than anybody. But you get hung up on that. Here I am as a, and by the way, the person ended up being, interestingly enough, in the healing arts, because if no one helped them, then they were going to help. You know, the old saying that so many people who have experienced child abuse either become criminals or rescuers. And this person became a rescuer and very fulfilling career. But there's like this nagging thing. How do you work through something like that mentally? Because it's not really regret. But no matter what I try to say to this person, they don't see it that way.
Well, you're right. It's, if we define regret as a negative feeling about a decision I made, he did not make the decision to be abused. So he was an innocent victim. And he might be correct that if he had not been an innocent victim of abuse, his life would have been better. And that might be true. That might very well be true. But then the next question is, and then what? We could all think about, I can't imagine anybody I've ever known who can't imagine how their life could have been better, right? I mean, there's nothing in real life that can anyway compare with your fantasy about how things could be better.
That's a really, really good point. I think all of us have that. If I lived in a different place, if my parents did a different, you know, you just kind of go to all these places. And you're right. I think that's a natural comparison in a big way. You know, you just do. You're learning about your environment, other people, other ecosystems, and you wonder to yourself, wonder what I would have been like if.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is that when they've looked at the use of the word regret in printed documents over the last 150 years in English, there's actually a Google search engine you can do this, that there's been an enormous increase in the use of the word regret since the 1980s.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, enormous. And if you think about regret as sort of a combination of high expectations, the perception of opportunity that I could do better, I should do better, you know, the emergence of greater inequality and seeing people who are billionaires and their lifestyle, the growth of social media in the last 20 years. There's been an increase of perfectionism by 30%.
Well, just look at Instagram. I'm not perfect.
Absolutely, yeah. And so all of that feeds into the would have, could have, should have. But yes, your life could have been better. But the question is, what are you going to do now? So you're on the train journey, and you're not going to turn the train around and back up and relive your childhood. That's not on the journey. The question is, what do you do on the next stop? And the individual you spoke of, Pam, actually made good use of his trauma, like maybe a post-traumatic growth in a way that he became somebody in the healing area. And who can heal somebody better than someone who's been through it to help people through that journey? That, I think, is an example. I mean, all of us could think about how our lives could be better, but we don't think about how our lives could be worse. Here's a way in which our life could be worse. You can never have been born. I like to think, how unlikely is it, Pam, that you or I ever existed? You know, our great-grandparents had to meet. They had to conceive your grandparents and so forth, and all the way down the generation. The likelihood that any single person would exist is close to zero. So in some ways, it's kind of like, maybe it's not the gift that you thought would be the best gift, but the fact that you actually exist and have choices now and in the future is a lot better than the zero point.
It's the practice of gratitude. Every single time I hear someone do the, you know, I said, stop, listen, wake up in the morning, you know, make that list of gratitudes in your life. And if you just want to say three of them, realize, especially as you age, you wake up in the morning, do the anatomical inventory. Does everything still work? And then you just, and then you kind of go from there. It's like, it's going to be a good day. Everything works. As a physician, my work was in critical care and trauma, as well as internal medicine. This is before I went back into academia as a clinical investigator at the National Institutes of Health. I had the exquisite honor and privilege of being there for so many people as they passed away. You know, and I know about Bronnie Ware's book, The Five Regrets of the Dying. And obviously, it's not just five, but I think she was just playing around, you know, with some of the big guys. When I first read that, it kind of struck home. And I thought about all the people I personally had dealt with, you know, along those lines. It was the people who, it was really interesting. The people with the only regret is, I wish I could see my grandchildren grow up or something very natural, nothing negative in that regard. It's just, hey. But the people who were most satisfied with their lives and were facing death, the ones who could actually talk about it before they pass, if they had a life that had been led with meaning and purpose, and that was rich in their eyes, meaning that they loved their family and friends, they had a fabulous way to be able to do their work, whatever it may have been, and back and forth. I'll never forget, as long as I live, this absolutely magnificently beautiful woman who was only 50, who was sitting in front of me, and I was going to help her in this part of her journey. She had pancreatic cancer, which we all know is mostly terminal in a very short period of time. It is a heinous cancer. And she was wealthy. She had everything. Wonderful, loving husband, beautiful children, contributed to the community. And she looked at me, you know, I'm sitting there with my stomach tied up in knots, because even though I've seen this million, you know, it still always affects me because I'm a human being. And she looked at me straight in the eye. And she goes, you know, I don't want what's going to happen to me. But, you know, I'm really okay, because this is what's going to happen. And up to this point in my life, it's been wonderful. And so I'm going to embrace this part too. I mean, I just about fell out of my chair. I was just, wow. So I think, you know, as we're kind of drawing this to a close, the whole issue of regret and living a life that you define as one with meaning and purpose, does that help you with this whole navigating regret?
Well, yeah, I think there are several ways of looking at it. No one ever says at the end of their life, gee, I really regret having gratitude, appreciation, being kind, having purpose, and being engaged in my life. I mean, spending time with my friends or telling people I love them. No one ever regrets that. At least I've never heard people regret that. So having a purposeful life, having connections, telling people you love them, is a great way of living a meaningful life. But having said that, when you come to the end of a meaningful life, you're coming to the end of something that's very valuable. It's natural, even for that person who has a meaningful life, to not welcome death. I mean, it's quite courageous and remarkable that someone can be accepting of their dying. You know, I remember a friend of mine telling me many years ago, his grandmother was like 94 years old and she was dying, and he visited her. I mean, she said, you know, Alan, you might think I'm 94, I could be okay with dying at 94, but frankly, I'd like a few more years.
Yeah,
it's a good life. I mean, I think a way of looking at it, we're all going to die, but the answer to the fear of death is to embrace life up to the last moment. And I think that's, you know, to be completely aware, completely engaged, do as much as you can, as long as you can, if you can. And I think that's the way to approach life, if you can do that. But there are people who say, as they're facing their death, they are elderly, they get caught up in regrets about things that happened when they're 20s, and they begin fantasizing about how their life could be better. Even if they're completely right, their life could have been better, and we don't know, it could have been worse or whatever. You're only going to make a bad situation worse by ruminating about it. getting on with your life now as much as you can is really the antidote to regret. One exercise that I to kind of maybe end with is, you know, people regretting they didn't have more success or marry the right partner or whatever, is for you to think about this. Imagine everything has been taken away. You don't exist. You have no body, no memory, no family, no possessions. You're nothing, absolutely nothing. And you can ask for one thing back at a time. For, let's say, hypothetical God figure, you can ask this God one thing at a time. I'm not going to tell you how many things you'll get back. The only way you can get anything back is if you convince me you really appreciate it and you're grateful. And I've tried this with so many people, Pam, and for many people, it brings tears to their eyes, but it freezes them right in their place. You know, they think, I want my kids back. I want my partner back. And why? What do you appreciate about them? And in every case I've ever done this exercise with, people want the ordinary universal things back. They want their family. They want the people they love. They want their eyesight. They want their ability to hear, to listen, to feel. They want their memory. They want almost all the things they already have, except irony of it, Pam, is they've been so caught up in their regret or their worry or their anger, they haven't noticed what's right in front of them all along. So you know that when someone you love dies, that the thing that you regret is that you didn't tell them you loved them. But you can do that in your life on an ongoing basis.
I just love that, because what you've just done in your final comments here is you've once again drilled home gratitude, what are you grateful for? And I love piling on all of the things that you now think about as absolutely pivotal in your life. And now you have a chance to actually say why, instead of taking for granted things that are just around. I think this is a moment where you sort of sit back and you reflect, which is something most people don't do. You know, this is why I highly recommend journaling and, you know, spending time in reflection. Last time I looked, it was called meditation. And just having a moment to say, whoa, stop for a moment. Let's have a little look. Not bad. And it's pretty amazing. And, you know, the other thing is as a physician, you know, I listen oftentimes sometimes to people who are saying, oh, I wish I had this and that bigger house and blah, blah, blah. And then you look at many people who've had, you know, these things, and they have so many other issues and problems. And not to break anyone's heart, everyone gets cancer. Everyone gets it. You know, it just because you have more money. I was just reading that there's a new Bob Marley movie out that's coming out. It made me remember that he died of melanoma at the age of 36, for crying out loud. I mean, it's just one of those random, meanwhile, you look at his life, which is incredible, and you know, all these things and back and forth. So what you have to do is just do exactly what you said, and that's reframe it. By stripping it down to nothing, you have a chance to build it out again, but this time being completely aware of why you're grateful for every one of those elements you just added back in, your kids, your family, you know, all the rest of it, which I just love. Everyone out there, we have been talking to Dr. Robert Leahy, and he is the author of a book that's just a must. If you really want to get out of your regret rabbit hole, read If Only, Finding Freedom from Regret, again, by Dr. Robert Leahy. And this is over at Amazon and all the other great places you could find it. I just can't thank you enough, Robert, for being on the Her podcast. And I now dub you what I call my, what I say to my producers as a repeat offender, because we're just going to have to drag you right back on again as we begin to attack so many of these other issues as it relates to this. So thank you so much for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you, Pam, for having me. You've been very kind. Your questions have been excellent.
Well, we try, you know, I mean, it's, we actually do something, you know, I'm always laughing as an author, you know, when I'm on podcasts and they say, oh, we have to have you on, you know, look at the Hunger Fix and, you know, Body for Life for Women and whatever. And they haven't even read the damn thing. And they're like, well, let's just talk about it. Wait a minute. Do your homework, I always say. So that's why I have a lot of fun with this. So again, thank you, Dr. Robert Leahy. All right, and here's another shout out to our sponsor, and that's Solaray Vitamins. And remember the Her Life Stages products. Please ask about them. They're award-winning. Go on over to your local health food store, check it out. And then also go to solaray.com, use promo code HER20 for 20% off. Oh boy, it's all good for you, you know? Look, this has been another amazing Herb podcast. I'm Dr. Pam Peek and your host. And I want to thank each and every one of you for listening in and being such an important part of our Herb podcast community. Pop on over to drpeek.com to learn more about my work and social media. Join me every single week for another Herb podcast where you're going to hear from extraordinary, entertaining, and engaging thought leaders like Dr. Robert Leahy, as we share our wit and wisdom, really heavy on the wit, for you to enjoy. Thanks so much. And remember that, you know, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and seize the day. Have a great one.